This is New Books in Communication, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Jeff Pooley from Muhlenberg College, and I am thrilled to have Sarah Bannerman, author of The Struggle for Canadian Copyright, Imperialism to Internationalism, 1842 to 1971, on the podcast today. Welcome to New Books in Communication, Sarah, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, so The Struggle for Canadian Copyright, which is published by the University of British Columbia Press this year, narrates a pretty complex story of Canada's copyright policy since the mid-19th century. The book details the country's halting attempts to craft a copyright regime that's responsive both to its position as a net importer of published work and to its peculiar political geography as a British dominion bordering the United States. Sarah charts Canada's early, largely unsuccessful effort to craft a less restrictive policy in the run-up to and aftermath of the 1886 Berne Convention, the multilateral agreement that established the framework for the international copyright system. The main obstacle in the 19th and early 20th centuries was Britain's insistence on a uniform and Berne-friendly policy throughout the empire. Even as those imperial constraints fell away, Sarah describes how over the first half of the 20th century, Canada increasingly aligned itself with powerful net exporters like France and Britain, in part, she shows, to strengthen the country's image as a model international citizen. The struggle for Canadian copyright is a story, in effect, of constraint. The country's copyright independence was never won, but Bannerman's account also highlights the historical contingency of the restrictive norms that now dominate international IP policy. It's lucid, it's cleanly written, it's a concise account, and it was a pleasure to read. So, Sarah, can you say a little bit about your background? If I'm not mistaken, you were trained in communication and now work in a communication department. What led you into this arena of copyright policy?
Well, it all started about 15 years ago when the Recording Industry Association of America sued Napster. And at that time, I had done an undergraduate degree in music, and I did music composition and songwriting myself, in the course of my degree and in my own kind of as a hobby. And so the idea, first of all, that you could download music from the internet, I remember hearing about MP3s and just being blown away by that idea. And then that there was this new intermediary that was out there just really fascinated me. I had this sense that music making could become something really different if it wasn't mediated by the big labels. And I think that's the vision that Napster really brought. If people could communicate recorded music directly with each other, musical community and music making could look very different. And so Napster really brought with it this dream that gripped me, and it was the reason why I went back to school and the thing that really drove all of my studies from that point on. I wanted to know everything possible and to really understand the whole situation. Of course, what digital music also did was it sparked a great ideological divide, a fight over copyright. And I became really interested in that. I went back to school to do my master's degree and my PhD at Carleton University in Ottawa, as you say. And then I went on to do a Fulbright postdoc at George Washington University and another postdoc at the Australian National University before joining McMaster University in Canada, where I am now. But in the process of all of this, I also got interested in the international aspects of copyright, because I saw that some of the biggest issues in copyright today and in intellectual property today were not only to do with the ability of people in rich countries to download music from the internet, but there were also other issues like access to medicine, patent issues, large-scale access to knowledge in poorer countries. And I saw how international law and international relations were really crucial to how copyright policy was made in Canada and in other countries. And I thought that those huge inequalities between states were really important in that. And so I became interested in all of those issues as well, and also in the history of Canadian copyright, because in the process of my work on current issues in Canadian copyright, I realized that there wasn't really a book or a good understanding out there of where Canadian copyright history really came from.
And so was that the motivation for this book? Was it to sort of fill in the backstory of Canadian copyright that you are working on in the present? I mean, if you could speak to that, and also whether it was a dissertation, and if so, how did the process of transforming it into a book work out?
Yeah, this book was my dissertation. And I think from the beginning of writing that dissertation, I had the idea that it would be a book. It was an important topic, and I thought we really needed to understand the history of Canadian copyright. But also, it really was inspired by current events. I was watching what was happening in international copyright today, and I had certain kind of hopes or ideas about Canada and what Canada's role was or should be. And I think that that's really something that's been brought to mind also recently. The death of Nelson Mandela has happened recently, and one of the sort of perspectives that we've been hearing about a lot in Canada is Canada's role in the anti-apartheid movement, and there's a lot of reflection about that now after his death. And I think Canada did play a role in the struggle against apartheid, and certain Canadian figures did, and Canadian politicians and Canadian groups. And it's very inspiring kind of to think about Canada's ability without being a major power to still on particular issues or at particular points to have influence in the world. Canadian Prime Minister Mulroney showed leadership in calling for sanctions at the UN against South Africa, challenged Thatcher and Reagan privately and publicly on those issues. And so we've been reminded recently about what Canadian leadership can kind of do in particular instances. And there are all kinds of opportunities for leadership today, including in the field of copyright, which is a field where great inequalities do play out. There are countries in the world where it costs a month's salary to buy one legitimate copy of an American DVD. And there are negotiations happening right now and recently over a lot of these inequalities to try to in copyright to try to mitigate them. Recently, country delegations gathered to negotiate a new Marrakesh Treaty. It's currently estimated that only 5% of works, literary and artistic works or books, are available in accessible format to people who are visually impaired. And the Marrakesh Treaty was an effort to try to end the so-called book famine, partially caused by the fact that copyright law makes it illegal to share accessible formatted books across borders. And so this was an instance where leadership by particular countries and by particular groups, especially India, Brazil, some African countries were really important in leading on this issue to help solve the problem of the book famine for the visually impaired internationally. And it's an inspiring story. There are also instances where leadership has failed and turned out to be a mirage. And so in all of these sorts of issues that are currently going on, I asked myself, well, what was Canada's role, or what should Canada's role be, or why is Canada constrained from taking a role in international treaty negotiation on international copyright? And so it was that idea of Canada's potential leadership that kind of inspired me to write this book.
Great. And we'll take up the substance of the Canadian story in a moment, but I was curious about the methodological challenges you faced. I mean, the book is relatively short and concise, but it takes in over a century. And it's, as you've already heard, it's not just Canada, but involves the world's international copyright system, both at Berne and in the aftermath at countless conferences and conventions all around the world. It's a huge mass of materials. It includes published records, public documents, I assume, like the parliamentary record, and also archival resources. I mean, how did you navigate access on the one hand and limit yourself on the other to keep your project within limits and to keep its coherence as a narrative?
Yeah, you're right. It does draw on a huge amount of archival research. And I've made a lot of those documents actually available on a companion site for the book, where I've posted the photographed documents, many of them that I used in researching the book. And you're right, I drew on many other sources, published records, newspaper records even, Hansard and everything like that. I think the fact that it focuses on international copyright was one way of narrowing things down, rather than trying to focus on every issue that's come up in the history of Canadian copyright. I really focused on the international ones, and Canada's relationship with the Berne Convention. And that also allowed me to zero in on particular points in time, points where Canada joined the Berne Convention, attempted to denounce the Berne Convention, and then at the various revision conferences of the Berne Convention as well, which happened about every 20 years. So it provides certain narrow kind of points in time where I could focus my research sort of throughout that century.
Great. Well, to set up the discussion, I was hoping you could provide a kind of overview. You know, you tell the story of various alternative copyright proposals that were either stalled or half implemented or thwarted in lots of cases. It's basically a story of paths not taken in a way. And I thought maybe you could explain your subtitle, and it has those two terms. You're really describing an arc from imperialism to internationalism in terms of the constraints that Canada faced. And so if you could just explain that arc.
Sure. The story starts in 1842, really, when the British imperial government made the decision that imperial copyright would apply throughout all of the colonies of the British Empire. And so that meant that for the first time, British copyright was effective in Canada. So there was that layer of imperial copyright going on in Canada. But the other layer was the fact that, of course, Great Britain had the power to not enact, to refuse to enact Canadian legislation, or to require that it be modified or whatever, or refuse it royal assent. So there were all kinds of layers of control by imperial copyright applying in Canada, and also by the control that the imperial government had over Canadian legislation. And that's really where the story starts. But then where the story goes is that as Canada gradually gained independence over its own legislation, Canada, what was also forming at the same time was this system of international copyright. And part of the argument of the book is that the international copyright system really took on many of the functions that the imperial copyright system had performed before that. It ensured uniformity among countries as to how copyright would look, what the standards of copyright would be, what kinds of rights copyright holders would be granted. And it also allowed the core of copyright producing countries, copyright exporters, to maintain control over the international copyright system and have real advantages over the more peripheral countries to prevent policies that would have allowed more peripheral countries like Canada to get a bigger slice of the publishing pie, or the later the larger cultural industry pie.
Great. So that really is the sort of story you tell, and the transition period is sometime, you know, after World War I, it seems to me. But let's go back for a moment into the 19th century, and just to set the scene, I mean, the Berne Convention of 1886 plays such a central role in your story, and obviously in the story of international copyright. And so could you just explain what it was and its significance?
Yeah. The Berne Convention was the first real multilateral copyright treaty, in the sense that it was the first one that any country could join. There are other sort of multi-country intellectual property or copyright treaties before the Berne Convention, but it was the first really broad one. And it did two things. The first thing it did was it granted international copyright on a national treatment basis. So it required that countries would treat foreign nationals the same as they treated domestic nationals. So it meant that, say, an American book would be granted copyright on the same basis as a Canadian book would be granted copyright in Canada, that Canadian copyright would protect both of those books in the same way, and that all countries would do that. And the second thing that it did was it set a number of minimum standards as to what copyright would look like and what rights copyright holders would have over their works. So it would grant, it now grants, for example, a minimum term of protection of the life of the author plus another 50 years. It required that countries could not make copyright conditional on the completion of formalities such as registering the work or having the work printed in a particular country. Those types of formalities were forbidden ultimately under the Berne Convention. Now an American DVD is protected under Canadian copyright law, whether or not it was manufactured in Canada. So it sets those kinds of minimum standards.
Okay, great. So then we enter the point when Canada, well, in a way, was a kind of reluctant, almost accidental signatory. And it wasn't really a signatory, since it was the British who acceded to the Union in 1886. But maybe you could say something about the resistance that came after Canada through the empire joined the Berne Convention, resistance to the kind of copyright treaty, including the attempt a few years later to basically back out of Berne. What drove the resistance, and why was the issue of compulsory licensing such a flashpoint?
Well, what really drove Canada's resistance to the Berne Convention was American resistance to the Berne Convention and to international copyright in general. The United States didn't grant international copyright at all until 1891. And so at the point where the Berne Convention was founded, the United States didn't recognize international copyright at all. So that meant that American printers and publishers, because that was the main copyright industry at the time, could freely and legally reprint foreign books, say British books or whatever, without permission from the British copyright holder. And that was perfectly legal. And it was tied to an American policy of encouraging political debate, of education, of free speech, of ensuring access to foreign works for its people. And so Canada at that time, for its part, did have international copyright under imperial copyright law. And so that was the real tension. Canada was kind of torn between the British, between, I guess, wanting to respect international copyright, but being situated right beside this neighbor that wasn't constrained by international copyright. And Canada was in a similar economic situation with the U.S. as well. It was developing, it was trying to establish domestic industries to ensure education for its people. And Canada was very different from the European countries at that time. We didn't have a system of libraries at the time. And so if you wanted to read books, you had to buy them. And so what happened was the Americans could reprint very cheap editions of British books, and those books would be imported into Canada. Canada and Canadian printers and publishers, for their part, were constrained by international copyright and therefore couldn't compete with the American reprinters and the imports of books that were coming into Canada. And so that was the real source of the problem for Canadian printers and publishers. They couldn't compete. They couldn't, through competing, accumulate capital to be able to grow. And so what happened when copyright law was imposed on Canada was that those American reprint inexpensive books were forbidden from being imported into Canada. For a period of time, it was a copyright infringement under imperial copyright law to import those inexpensive American editions of British books. And so Canadians lost an important source of inexpensive books. And so that was a real problem for Canadians, for the printers and publishers who couldn't compete, and also for consumers. And so the compromise solution was that the British allowed those imports from the U.S. to come in again if the Americans paid a tariff of 12.5%. The Canadians would collect this tariff, and then that would be fine under imperial copyright law, which was changed to allow this. So now the Americans could legally sell pirated, but it was legal, books in the Canadian market by paying this 12.5% tariff. And what the Canadian printers and publishers wanted was to be able to do the same thing under a compulsory license rather than a tariff. So they wanted to be able to, without asking permission from the copyright holder, they wanted to just be able to go through the Canadian government to be able to pay the 12.5% royalty, and that way to be able to kind of compete on the same playing field with the American printers and publishers.
Great. And so this was the situation, you know, leading up to, and then, of course, after Byrne. And as I mentioned before, as the book details, there was this attempt to sort of back out of Byrne, in effect. And this didn't really succeed in the long run. And you tell the story of how the British basically forced Canada's hand over the next couple of decades. And if you could just briefly describe what happened.
Yeah, what happened was Canada, the conservative government at the time in 1886 decided to implement the Berne Convention, and they knew it would be controversial, but Prime Minister Macdonald, who was Canada's first prime minister, saw Canada as being united with, subservient to, but united with and supporting British Empire. And I think that the conservatives thought it would be embarrassing if this debate about basically legalizing piracy in a way came out in Canada, and if that played out in Parliament. And so when the Liberal opposition called for debate in Canadian Parliament about all of these questions, about compulsory license, about copyright in general, and about the Berne Convention, the Conservatives in power just shut that down. It was not debated in Parliament. They said, let's discuss it after the Berne Convention is kind of together. And so the Liberals in opposition backed down, and there was no debate held in Canadian Parliament about the Berne Convention. In fact, the opposition didn't really know where the Berne Convention was at. In fact, the Canadian government really wasn't all that informed about what was happening with the negotiation of the Berne Convention leading up to 1886. Instead, they were kind of informed at the last minute about the Berne Convention, about the fact that the imperial government wanted to implement the Berne Convention. And they were kind of sent a package and said, do you consent to join the Berne Convention? And they could have said no, but Prime Minister MacDonald, from his library in his mansion, said sent a short telegram, six words that kind of sealed Canada's copyright fate. Canada consents to enter copyright convention. And from that point on, there wasn't any almost point in debating the question of compulsory licensing or the question of trying to equalize the situation with the United States, because Canada was now signed on. But what happened when Justice Minister Thompson announced implementation of the Berne Convention and Canada's intention to enact new legislation that would conform with the Berne Convention and which would not have included the compulsory licensing provision, was that there was a huge uproar. And the printing and publishing industry was up at arms and sent a delegation to Ottawa to talk to Thompson. And who turned around, who did a huge about face overnight, and moved instead to enact a very different legislation, which did include the compulsory licensing provision and also included a request to the imperial government that Canada would denounce the Berne Convention. Canada didn't have the sufficient independence to denounce the Berne Convention itself, but it requested that the imperial government do that on Canada's behalf. That kind of sat in limbo and intention between Canada and the imperial government for years. The Canadian Copyright Act that contained these provisions was unanimously passed in the Canadian Parliament. But because the act was not compatible with the Berne Convention, Canada would have had to denounce it. And what the British were afraid of was that if Canada denounced the Berne Convention, this was in 1889 now, just 3 years after the whole thing was formed, the British were afraid that other countries would follow suit and that the entire Berne Convention would break apart as other colonies especially followed Canada's lead. And so imperial power was used to not allow this Canadian Copyright Act that had been unanimously passed in Canadian Parliament to come into force. And the British government just never moved to denounce the Berne Convention on Canada's behalf. So Prime Minister Thompson, who had been the Justice Minister and was now the Prime Minister, wrote long letters to Britain. He got very angry. He refused to meet British representatives over this issue. And he ultimately went to London to negotiate on the copyright issue. And it looked like progress was being made. But at Windsor Castle on December 12th, 1894, Prime Minister Thompson died of a heart attack right there on that visit. And his body was returned home to Canada in a boat with the sides painted black, and the dream of Canadian copyright sovereignty was never realized.
Great. Well, you know, the story picks up again in the aftermath of World War One, and it's a really fascinating period, in part because Canada, you know, with all of its sacrifices and loyalty in the war, won more autonomy and kind of de facto independence from the British. And yet at the same time, there were demands for, you know, cultural protections from American cultural goods. And Canada was producing its own flood of new non-print, you know, oral and visual media products in the kind of burgeoning culture industry. There's lots of debate going on in this interwar period, confusion. And despite holding on, it seems to me, to the compulsory licensing policies on paper, Canada joined the Berne Union on its own, and basically in the long run accepted the norms of the international system, and not because of the British, really, right? But instead, because it was interested, at least in part, to shape its image as a kind of international player. If you could talk about that.
Yeah. Well, what happened at one point in between here, well, the U.S. started to recognize international copyright, but on the condition that the book was reprint or was manufactured in the U.S. And so the issue shifted away from the compulsory licensing question to the question of domestic manufacture. The U.S. could require books to be printed in the U.S., and Canada couldn't. Because the Berne Convention forbade that. It was a formality that was forbidden under the Berne Convention. So that was the real issue. And in 1911, there was an imperial copyright conference where the British Empire got together and said, what are we going to do about copyright? And Canada kind of stood up in that at that point in time and said, we want to be able to have Canadian legislation on copyright, sovereignty over the copyright issue. And a lot of the British colonies didn't want that, and Great Britain wanted a certain level of conformity on the copyright issue. So what was decided was that British dominions or colonies would be allowed to legislate themselves on copyright if their legislation was substantially similar to the British legislation. And so that was the groundwork that we were working on after World War I and in the 1920s when Canada finally did move to legislate on copyright. But the interesting thing that happened in between was part of that deal in 1911 was that Canada wanted to be able to negotiate reciprocal copyright with the United States. If the United States required domestic manufacture, Canada wanted to be able to require domestic manufacture as well, in a way. And so we required the Berne Convention to be modified for that. And it was modified. The amazing thing is that in 1914, the British were wanting Canada to update their copyright laws. And Canada said, we can't, we need this provision that you promised us in 1911 at the Imperial Copyright Conference. And so Great Britain actually contacted all of the other countries of the Berne Convention and said, look, we need this provision for Canada. We have to modify the Berne Convention, otherwise we're out. And so all the countries got together and modified and created this relatively minor provision, exception kind of to the Berne Convention, that would have allowed Canada, or that did allow Canada, to grant or not grant copyright to countries that did not protect copyright on a similar basis. And by that, Canada really meant the United States. And that allowed Canada ultimately in 1923-24, when it did finally update its copyright law, to put in place compulsory licensing provisions that really applied against Canada and countries that were not members of the Berne Union, like the United States. And what the provision said was, although formalities are not normally allowed under the Berne Convention, in the case of countries that are not members of the Berne Convention and that do not protect copyright in the same way, such as the United States, which requires domestic manufacture, in those cases, anyone can apply for a compulsory license to be able to get a Canadian copyright for those works. So Canadians, technically under the new law of 1924, which in all respects, almost all respects, was almost word for word a copy of the British legislation. So it met that requirement of being substantially similar to the British legislation, but it contained that little exception with compulsory licensing that could apply against Americans, so that a Canadian, for example, could get a license from the Canadian government to reprint an American work. And it's my understanding that that provision, although it was fought for, and the debates that went on in Canadian Parliament over this question, was never actually used. But nevertheless, the provision was there, and it showed that kind of modicum of copyright sovereignty in what otherwise was a direct copy of British legislation.
Okay, excellent. That was an important clarification. Okay, good. And, you know, thinking about the post-World War II period, as you describe in the book, there were just massive changes in the copyright system. And in particular, you know, after the wave of decolonizations in starting in the mid-50s, you know, a number of newly independent states were party to or engaged in negotiations around issues of copyright and other IP issues. And in particular, there arose, especially in this mid-60s, a kind of development agenda. The issues around Berne and copyright crested in 1967 in a meeting at Stockholm, in the aftermath of which led to a kind of crisis in the international system. And so I thought maybe you could just set the scene about what happened in 1967 and in the aftermath, but especially Canada's somewhat awkward role where at times it would flirt with the idea of classifying itself as a developing country or aligning itself with developing countries. At other times, and maybe more persistently, defining itself as a middle power. And then ultimately, in practice, aligning itself with the more powerful net exporters. So anyway, if you could just talk about that 1967 conference in the aftermath.
Yeah, well, I argue that, and Escobar has argued that, that development became the kind of new purpose of international institutions around the 50s. And that was true in copyright as well. Whereas up to that point, development, it had been mentioned in the history of Canadian copyright as a tool of industrial development in Canada and that kind of thing. But it wasn't a central focal point in international copyright until the 1950s and 60s, when decolonization was going on and all kinds of newly independent countries were emerging. And the question arose at that point of time, it was how will the Berne Convention deal with these new countries that are newly independent and that have, in a large number, been part of the Berne Union as colonies? And a lot of those countries had new demands if they were going to be part of the Berne Union. And the Berne Union really faced an identity crisis at that point. Will we kind of be this high standard of international copyright that's really aimed at the most highly developed countries, although I don't like that term, but anyway, or will we try to kind of lower the standards of international copyright in order to be a big tent kind of form of international copyright? Around that same time, there was a competing international copyright convention that was formed called the Universal Copyright Convention. And the Berne Union was worried that that convention would become the Universal Convention, and that the Berne Convention would sort of fade into obsolescence or something like that. So they decided to take the big tent approach and to kind of try to also meet the demands of newly independent developing countries. And at that time, the whole question of what was a developing country was actually still up in the air and was being discussed. What defines a developing country was a question that was still kind of an open question. And Canada in all of this time from the 1920s had become kind of disengaged from international copyright. It seems that the bureaucracies were actually not really following closely what was happening, even at the time of the formation of the Universal Copyright Convention. And different advisory commissions in Canada had kind of advised that, well, Canada is a net copyright importer that's not really well served by higher and higher copyright standards, because what happens with higher standards of international copyright is that we end up paying more royalties out of the country. And so that was kind of, Canada was kind of drifting along like that. But when the developing countries and the newly independent countries started demanding new provisions in international copyright, they started demanding looser translation requirements so that domestic producers could produce translations into many different languages of works. They started to require that to request exceptions so that educational institutions could make copies of works without having to pay huge amounts of royalties to rich countries and those kinds of things. And Canada started asking itself, and certain particular bureaucrats started asking themselves, well, where is Canada in all of this, and what kind of position should Canada take? And in 1967, Canada wasn't all that involved, but the settlement that was come to when the Berne Convention was revised that year were some fairly radical exceptions for things like education in developing countries, that developing countries would be able to make copies of works for educational purposes, for example, without worrying about copyright royalties or rights or anything like that. And after that settlement was come to, there was a huge outcry internationally from rights holder groups, and they hated these huge exceptions, what they saw as huge exceptions for developing countries. And at that time, Canada was kind of asking itself, what position should Canada take? And there were certain Canadian politicians and bureaucrats who proposed that Canada was actually a developing country because we were a net copyright importer, and therefore also benefited from looser international copyright provisions, that maybe Canada should try to get classified as well as a developing country. And of course, this idea really went nowhere in the end. Some of the diplomats who were in control of the decision-making at this time sort of said, could we tone this down, because it's kind of the idea of Canada as a developing country is it will be seen with derision on the international stage. But at the same time, there was this tension, and when 1971 came along and the 1967 settlement had not been accepted, it had to be renegotiated in 1971. Canada had a position by that point, and the position was that Canada would try to kind of support the developing country's position, but kind of sort of stay in the middle. And there was an effort actually to try to create a coalition of middle countries like Canada. Canada declared itself to be in the middle between developing and developed countries, and to understand both sides, to have a special perspective understanding both sides. And Canada really wasn't successful in forming a coalition of middle powers on these issues. And the settlement that was come to, that was made at that point, was much more restrictive. And the exceptions that were made in 1971 did come into effect, but were so restrictive, really, that they were very rarely, if ever, used by developing countries.
And that really brings us to the end of the substance of your narrative. You really close the book in 1971 in that kind of renegotiation of the 1967 arrangements. But you do, in your conclusion, trace the period after 1971, including the incorporation of the new World Intellectual Property Organization, which became a UN agency and took on the Berne Convention and other IP-related portfolios. And you talk about this post-1971 period, including the way in which the United States copyright policy became more expansionist and restrictive. And in this period, it seems that Canada hasn't pressed its middle power intermediate position agenda much. Instead, it has aligned itself with the net exporting countries like the United States more unambiguously. And so I don't know if that's fair as a characterization, and if so, what happened?
yeah, after 1971, Canadian creator groups, I guess, became the more dominant voice in Canadian copyright policymaking. It's interesting because there were certain points in time, in 1889, for example, or in 1967, or in 71, where the kind of user groups, the groups calling for exceptions, the groups calling for lower standards of international copyright, if I put it that way, were dominant. But after 1971, that was no longer the case. And the creator groups, the copyright holder groups, were really much, much more dominant and much more, I guess, vocal and sort of won more of the copyright battles. And I think that is true right up until the debates over digital copyright in the 2000s and in the late 90s. And I think that what's going to be really interesting is right now there are a number of fascinating treaties on exceptions, which are very new. There, in the past, international copyright almost always dealt primarily with the rights granted to rights holders. But with the Marrakesh Treaty dealing with the visually impaired exceptions, and there are other treaties currently in negotiation at WIPO for exceptions for libraries and educational institutions and that kind of thing, it'll be very interesting to see what Canada's position is on those issues and how that plays out. Canada has done some interesting, although Canada has in a large part followed many of the United States provisions, it also has carved out a certain amount of its own road or its own way on certain issues. The current Canadian Copyright Act has certain provisions for user-generated content that allow people to make non-commercial use of user-generated content on certain stipulations. And that's kind of an interesting made-in-Canada approach. Canada also has interesting made-in-Canada approaches on ISP liability, and also was one of the first countries to put in place certain exceptions for the visually impaired, even before the Marrakesh Treaty came along. And they're very limited, but Canada has been able to kind of do its own thing on certain relatively minor items. And we've also held so far to the now relatively shorter term of protection of life of the author plus 50 years. Right now, one of the treaties being negotiated is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is a trade agreement that includes intellectual property provisions. And recent leaks have revealed that Canada, along with other countries, has been resisting some of the American proposals for what some see as kind of more draconian intellectual property provisions under that treaty. And so we can still see some elements of Canadian kind of independence there in those negotiations. But I think it's still fair to say that for a large part, Canada does kind of toe the line in many instances on international copyright and on international intellectual property provisions. For example, the development issue has become very, very prominent at the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, and in the debates over how prominent development should be in WIPO as an agenda, Canada really somewhat resisted the development agenda along with the United States and the European Union. And I've written about that in another paper, Canada and the Development Agenda at WIPO. So in many cases, I think it's fairly fair to say that Canadian participation has been in line with American and European participation. It hasn't very often, if ever, really been in line with the developing country coalition. And in a sense, I think what Canadian participation does in many senses is it allows Canada to perform its role as being part of this international community of sort of great powers. And also it lends legitimacy to these negotiations to, say, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and those sorts of things.
And one of the points you stress throughout the book, especially in the beginning and the end, has to do with the contingency of both Canada's decision-making along the way and the shape that, you know, IP and copyright in particular in its policy orientation has taken, that it didn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to stay that way, that there's a sort of historical contingency that you've even kind of captured in speculating with some mild optimism about Canada's ability to carve out something like a middle power exceptionalism, perhaps going into the future when it comes to copyright and other IP issues, if only in a limited way. But so I don't know if you want to say something about that contingency, the fact that another set of policies is possible, even if it seems unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what's interesting is that there have been so many points in time where Canada, in its early years, almost achieved copyright independence, could have achieved copyright independence. There are points in time, Canada could have had copyright independence in the 1880s if certain events hadn't transpired, if certain bureaucrats hadn't kind of intervened. And it just so happened that a bureaucrat was there in charge of copyright who happened to have a thing for the Canadian authors of the future, that saw international copyright, indeed saw imperial copyright, as being in the interests of Canadian authors of the future, who at that time, Canadian authors were not publishing internationally. So imperial copyright and international copyright did nothing for them. But this bureaucrat had this vision of the future and therefore sort of thwarted Canadian copyright independence. And same thing in the 1971, if certain bureaucrats hadn't intervened and said, boy, Canada's going to look really silly on the international stage if we claim to be a developing country, who knows where that policy might have got to. But I think you say that I'm optimistic about a kind of middle power exceptionalism, and I'm not really very optimistic. I think there's room for Canada to carve out certain exceptions, to carve out certain Canadianisms in international copyright, and even for some of those to be taken up by other countries. After all, domestic legislation is really a source of innovation in innovation policy and can be taken up in certain instances. But I also think that Canada's and Canadian policymakers and Canadian diplomats are under enormous pressure from international interest groups and from the Americans and the Europeans and other copyright exporters to toe the line. And I think that now that copyright and intellectual property is tied in so much with the trade agenda, I think that copyright is one thing that Canada and other net copyright importers has to kind of trade off for other issues in order to be part of trade regimes and things like that. So I'm actually not very optimistic about Canada's potential for leadership. Now I see Canada as being too much in the middle to really lead in any direction. And I see countries like Brazil and India really playing the leadership roles on the one side, and then Europe and America playing the leadership roles on the other side of this real kind of ideological divide about copyright.
Okay, fair enough. That is an important clarification. So, you know, you've already brought up the work you're doing or have done recently on Canada's role at WIPO. I mean, is there a project that you're working on now that is it in fact related to these issues going on in multilateral negotiations treaties that you've been mentioning?
Yeah. Well, after I realized, originally I thought that Canada's copyright history was going to be very dry and uninteresting. But what I discovered through doing the research for this book was that Canada's story about international copyright was really unlike any other story I had read. It was this story of rebellion. It was Canada's rebellion had threatened the Berne Convention in its earliest days. And over looking at Canada's history, I kind of wondered to myself, would I see something similar if I looked at other countries who don't play a prominent role in the typical histories of international copyright? What about Australia and New Zealand? What about Haiti? What about Burkina Faso? Were those histories as dry and uneventful as their kind of near absence from the dominant story of international copyright would seem to indicate? And so now what I'm working on is a history of international copyright that tries to look at those other countries and to tell an almost anti-history of international copyright.
Wow, that sounds like a wonderful project. I'm really looking forward to it. Maybe we could have you on again. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk about the book, and congratulations again on a superb, fascinating book. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to New Books in Communications. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.